Greetings, listeners. This is Ralph Edwards, a.k.a. Warren, from the Concrete Gang and Creatures of the Industry podcast. I feel privileged to introduce the Concrete Gang 50th Anniversary Archive, because this is the 50th anniversary of the Concrete Gang on Community Radio 3CR, first started by the rank and file of the BLF, and now presented by the rank and file of the CFMEU. We've been presenting a weekly program about our industry and the struggles it's faced over those 50 years. In fact, since 3CR first went to air in February 1976. This archive comes in two parts. First, the good old days, inverted commas, when it was recorded on reel-to-reel and then recorded over. So, special thanks to our loyal listeners who have recorded them on their cassette tape recorders as they listened on a Sunday morning, and save them for everyone to enjoy again. Second part of the archive is when we entered the 21st century in the early 2000s and the show was digitally recorded and kept as we went. So the material, although patchy in its continuity, shows the transition of the Concrete Gang over 50 years, in those two parts of approximately 25 years each. So enjoy the listen, and thanks to all those who presented the program and all those who helped get it to air. You will find it on www.3cr.org.au/Concrete Gang 50 Years, all one word. Dare to struggle, dare to win.
Well, working in the summer heat and in the winter cold, and the labour power we sell, me boys, for a hard-earned weekly pay, produces mighty profits for the greedy MBA. So keep your powder dry and hold your head up high. It's class to class and face to face, our limit is the sky. We've got a fighting history and we never will be cowed. A builder's labourer is a name to make a man feel proud. And whether we were born here or born in Italy, in Greece or Spain or Ireland, in England or Fiji, we all of us are workers and united we must stand until the wealthy bludgers have been driven from our land. So keep your powder dry and hold your head up high. It's class.
This is the Concrete Gang, the Builders Labourers Program.
We've got a fighting history and we never will be cowed. A builder's labourer is a name to make a man feel proud. We face deregistration and it backfired in their face. We're not fooled by arbitration and we won't stay in our place. We hit the bosses hard and fast to win and keep our gains, and break a couple of concrete pours to back our log of claims. So keep your powder dry and hold your head up high. It's class to class and face to face, our limit is the sky. We've got a fighting history and we never will be cowed. A builder's labourer is a name to make a man feel proud. Yes, keep your powder dry and hold your head up high. It's class to class and face to face, our limit is the sky. We've got a fighting history and we never will be cowed. A builder's labourer is a name to make a man feel proud.
Welcome to the Concrete Gang, and tonight we have, as usual, hopefully, a few interesting things for you. We are continuing our criticism of the Soviet Union in answer to some criticisms we have received from building workers. We have a tape from Norm Gallagher concerning the campaign of the union to make the MBA pay the Medibank levy, amongst other things. So without any further ado, we'll get going. And go on, Joe.
Yeah, well, the first thing we're going to get onto is the Medibank question. And we're very pleased to tell you that the moratorium, the Medibank moratorium last Wednesday, was really a huge success, and it really raised the whole campaign to defend and extend Medibank to a much higher level, at least in Victoria. I think we mentioned last week that there's now a new campaign which is getting underway in large sections of the workforce, including the building industry now, you'll be pleased to know, to make the employers pay the levy, the Medibank levy, instead of the workers paying it out of their wages. And there was a meeting of the Builders Labourers Executive last Wednesday, which in fact endorsed this call to build as labourers. And on Thursday we got the following comment from Norm Gallagher, the State Secretary.
The Victorian branch executive has decided to recommend to the membership that they immediately place demands on the employers for them to pay for the Medibank levy. We believe that the attack by the Fraser government is one which the whole of the working class must resist. The attack that has been made on Medibank is an attack on the workers' wages and conditions, and therefore must be resisted at all costs. It is a direct wage cut, and I've got no doubt whatsoever that builders' labourers right throughout Australia will take up the call of the union in getting the employers to pay the Medibank levy. I can see serious industrial trouble arising if the employers refuse to do it.
Just as a footnote to this, the Federal Health Minister, Mr Hunt, a couple of days ago denied the claims that Medibank was causing widespread confusion. He said, "It's my own feeling that people who have been confused are those who have decided to take out private insurance and are concerned by the number of funds, prices and tables available to them." Such a comment simply shows how out of touch the government must be. It mustn't have even heard of the crowds extending onto the footpaths at all the Medibank offices, or of the thousands of phone inquiries that Medibank's been receiving every day for the past month. As one suburban chemist who'd missed every lunch hour for a week trying to explain the new scheme to confused people said, "If a government can't even provide for the health care of the people, then what can it do?"
Fair enough. And, of course, Australia's not the only country in the world where there's confusion and crisis. And we have a report from Xinhua News concerning the stand of the British workers against wage restraint. And the report reads, "Many representatives of grassroots trade unions have taken a firm stand against the creation of more unemployed by the monopolists and the continuation of wage restraint in any form. They held their ground at the annual meeting of the Trade Union Congress held in Brighton from September the 6th to the 10th. The Congress met at a time when economic crisis has gripped Britain for 3 years, with the monopolists trying to shift their difficulties onto the workers through massive layoffs and wage restraint. Britain's jobless total now tops 1.5 million, a record high since the war, and its consumer prices soar at an annual rate of more than 12%, higher than in all major capitalist countries. British workers have suffered greatly as a result. Discussions at the Congress meeting centred on the unemployment crisis and wage policy. Some speakers noted that unemployment has increased 127%. Since the Congress accepted the social contract formula of the government 2 years ago. They strongly demanded government measures to reduce unemployment. Otherwise, they said, the workers would protest through strikes or other political actions. A group of representatives tabled a joint motion against the wage restraint. The present wage policy has led to a deterioration in minimum wage rates and effectively lowered living standards, the motion said. Many representatives spoke against the Labor government's cut of its public spending, because they said that has aggravated the difficulties of the workers. In spite of the demands of the workers, however, the annual meeting, under the manipulation of the leadership of the Congress, subscribed once again to the government policy of wage restraint." Sounds pretty similar to here in a few ways, doesn't it, Joe?
Yeah, that's for sure. We've got a disc jockey who wants to leave the studio now, so if you'll just excuse the squeaking door as he gets out. It's 8 minutes past 6 on the Concrete Gang, 3CR. Now, the next one we're going on to is some criticism we have received on our criticism of the Soviet Union. Now, this has come from some building workers, and it's regarding comments we have made in recent programs about the Soviet Union. Oh, that door sounds really good, doesn't it, Kate?
Sure.
Yeah, I think we need a bit of oil around this studio. Yes. Well, the first thing we'd like to say, getting back to the comment, the first thing we'd like to say is thanks for the criticism. We welcome criticism, and it's only through criticism that this program is going to improve. Now, the guts of this particular criticism was that our attacks on the Soviet Union and Soviet activities amounts to anti-socialism, anti-communism, and pro-US imperialist sentiment. The question of the Soviet Union is certainly a crucial question. No one can deny that. The US imperialists are certainly also the number one exporters of Australia. No one denies that, and most people realise this and oppose the United States imperialists. However, many people view the Soviet Union as a socialist bastion that helps the workers. We just briefly like to outline our attitude. The Soviet Union was the world's first country to establish socialism. Under the leadership of Lenin, the Russian workers and peasants won their liberation. And under the leadership of Stalin, they constructed a powerful socialist state, which not only defeated Nazi Germany's attempts to rule the world, but also rendered great assistance to people all over the world struggling for liberation and socialism. But the Soviet Union, as it developed under Khrushchev and later Brezhnev, has destroyed its socialist system and replaced it with state monopoly capitalism. Instead of the dictatorship of the proletariat, where the workers are in charge of their own destiny, there is now a vicious fascist dictatorship where the new bourgeoisie ruthlessly exploit and oppress the Russian workers and peasants. Instead of aiding the international cause of socialism and liberation, the present-day Soviet rulers are hell-bent on world domination and beating the Yanks at their own game. In short, we believe that the Soviet Union is a dangerous and aggressive imperialist superpower. The Chinese have coined the term Soviet social imperialism. This, in our opinion, is an accurate description and means socialism in words, imperialism in deeds. Now, that's been a lot of bold statements there, and they obviously need a lot of backing up. Starting from this week and over the next few weeks, we're going to try and back up a lot of those assertions. The thing we're going to concentrate on today is the question of unemployment in the Soviet Union. If the Soviet Union is still a genuine socialist country, as some people would have us believe, then it obviously would not have any unemployment. Genuine socialist countries do not have unemployment, and when the Soviet Union was socialist, it did not have unemployment. What we're going to do now is read you an extract from a book by an American revolutionary called Martin Nicholas. The book is called The Restoration of Capitalism in the USSR. And this extract deals with the question of unemployment, and it bases itself on Soviet information, primarily, and Soviet economic professors. In 1967 in the Soviet Union, there was a thing called the Shekino experience, and it was based upon the Shekino chemical combine. A Soviet economist, T. Baranikova, I think that's how you say it, Keith. That'll do, yeah, had this to say. The intensive release of personnel, that's a nice way of saying unemployment, the intensive release of personnel is planned at enterprises engaged in the Shekino experiment. On the average, each of the enterprises participating in this experiment released, that is, sacked, 10 to 15% of its workforce. Between one-fifth and two-thirds of the layoffs, depending on the enterprise, were made possible, she reports, by the methods of combining occupations, or increasing the volume of work performed by the remaining workers. That sounds pretty familiar.
Doesn't it, Jeff?
Yes. In compensation for the sacking of some of these workers, cop this, will you, the workers who were left received as a bonus a portion of the funds saved in wages by dismissing their colleagues. In short, the standard capitalist methods of slave driving, upping the pace, making one worker do the work of two, were supplemented with the cannibalistic touch of throwing the surviving workers some scraps of the flesh of their departed comrades. But only scraps. This Baranikova went on to say that the bonuses received by the survivors were an insignificant amount, and the remainder of the savings went as bonuses for, you guessed it, profits. A full 1,000 workers were in fact laid off in the original trial at the Shekino combine itself, indicating that more than a bit of pruning that was going on. And the Shekino principles of sacking workers were endorsed by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union Central Committee in October 1969 and near the end of 1973 had spread to approximately 700 enterprises. Soviet workers who are laid off fall into a category that has no official existence. The bourgeois Sovietologist Marshall Goldman wrote in 1971 in a sarcastic tone, "While rummaging through the capitalist tool bag to find ways of accelerating labour productivity, the Russians have come up with still another device, unemployment compensation. Until February 1970, the Russians steadfastly denied there was unemployment in the USSR. And since unemployment did not exist, there was no need to have unemployment compensation. This reasoning, however, was little comfort to those who found themselves without jobs." Well, this is true enough, but the professor seems to be mistaken about unemployment compensation because already in 1969, another Soviet economist, Manovich, wrote, "In order for releases connected with technical progress, the euphemism for speed up, not to affect the living standards of workers and their families, the question must be discussed of establishing some government material support." The following year, Baranikova emphasised the necessity for practical implementation of material support for workers during the time they are between jobs, unemployed. An even more bitter aspect of their situation is that all the layoffs undertaken by the enterprise directors for economic reasons are strictly against Soviet law, as embodied in the Constitution of 1936, the Stalin Constitution. But the leadership of the Soviet Communist Party and the state treats the Soviet Constitution with contempt. The workers' law is now a dead letter in the Soviet Union.
Yes, well, I think it's the best thing to let the dog condemn himself. And as Joe mentioned before, most of that material came not from American sources or sources which you may think have vested interest in sort of making things up, but it came out of the mouths of the Soviet leadership themselves, and that is where the crunch comes. We also actually have a rather good
song coming up,
Sobriz tells me, and
it's from an American group called Odetta, and it's a working class song that we hope you
know. Odetta is not a group, she's a very well known singer, but nonetheless, you'll hear that for yourselves.
You're listening to the 50-year anniversary archive of the Concrete Gang. Unbelievable that we're still going. So listen on.
We're sailing across the river from Liverpool, heave away, Santiago. Round the Cape Horn, the Frisco Bay, way out in California. So heave her up and away we'll go, heave away, Santiana. Heave her up and away we'll go, way out to California. There's plenty of gold, so I've been told, heave away, Santiana. Plenty of gold, so I've been told, away out in California. Well, back in the days of 49, heave away, Santiana. Back in the days of the good old time, we
a small piece of information. It's actually a report prepared by a European Common Market Study Group, and the conclusion of this report is rather interesting because it in fact concludes that multinational corporations are deliberately causing inflation. The report accuses them of maintaining high prices in spite of technical progress and higher productivity, and of rigging the financial market. The report concludes by seeing only two ways to cure inflation. First, to accept periods of depression, that is, the uncontrolled boom-bust cycle of capitalism, which would fluctuate from periods of depression to renewed bouts of inflation, or secondly, to, quote, find a new development model incorporating full employment as well as environmental, educational and cultural improvements for all citizens, end quote. And this is, actually is a pretty extraordinary conclusion, because what it means is that a capitalist report has come to the conclusion that the only way to cure the ills of capitalism is socialism.
Nice to see there are a few honest capitalists about.
Not a word.
A few weeks ago, we asked for some contributions to a debate on all aspects of the housing industry in Australia. Well, we haven't actually been inundated with replies, but we've received a few. Today we're going to read out just one. And this letter says, according to government figures released a few weeks ago, the price for new home sites, that is for vacant land in Melbourne suburbs, rose by an average of around 15% over the last year. In some areas, the rises were much greater. In Whittlesea and Caulfield, the average prices more than doubled, while in Prahran today, vacant housing land averages about $42,000 a block. That's about six times the yearly take-home pay of a builder's labourer, and just for vacant land. Now, these figures naturally raise the question of how these prices for land are arrived at. It's generally agreed that the development costs of a block, that is, the provision of electricity, water, sewage and so on, average around $7,000, far less than the current selling prices. And at any rate, it's obvious that land prices have been increasing recently at rates far exceeding the inflation rate. That is, land prices have been increasing independently of the cost of providing these services. So what could be the value of the unimproved land itself? Well, clearly, the answer is that unimproved land can itself have no value, any more than can air or sunlight or wind, for it's provided by nature and not produced or contributed to by the expenditure of labour. Indeed, as we know, this was the history of land acquisition in Australia as elsewhere, where land was either seized by squatters without payment or purchased from the natives in exchange for trinkets. In fact, historically, it was only when private appropriation of land had transformed it into monopoly property that land could acquire a price at all. Then, however, the price or rent of land related to the future products of the soil, that is, its agricultural produce, in much the same way that the price of a machine is related to its future product. However, we're today talking not about farming land, but of unproductive urban housing land, the only use of which is to house the working people, who are themselves responsible for the entire productive wealth of the community. And it's obvious at once that a price for such land is nothing but an anachronism, that is, it's merely an outdated relic of days gone by. And that it's possible only because there exists a class which has acquired monopoly control over the ownership of land. In addition, it's obvious also that the vast speculative profits that have been reaped by the speculators in land during the booms of the 60s and 70s have nothing whatsoever to do with contributing to the productive wealth of the country. Rather, they're purely parasitic in character, and their sole social function is to redistribute the hard-earned wealth of the working people back to the wealthy classes. Thus, we claim, in conclusion, that it's not sufficient for governments to set up from time to time ineffectual bodies like urban land councils or land commissions to try vainly to influence the market price of land. Rather, the nationalisation of all urban housing land and the granting to all working people of the fundamental right of a place to live must be two of the principal demands of the people.
Right, well, we've got the time now on 23 past 6 on 3CR. You're listening to The Concrete Gang. We were going to go on now with a little anecdote about Martin Cash, an old bushranger who also happened to be a builder's labourer. But we're running out of time, so we'll have to save that up for next week. So we'll go on now with a brief segment on the building industry lockout of 1975.
Well, we're going to hear a poem, but first a few words of introduction. There's a myth propagated by the capitalist media and taught to children in schools from an early age that in Australia today no one any longer knows hunger or want. However, the million or so people living below the poverty line and the 250,000 people unemployed in Australia know the truth, as do most other working people involved in the daily struggle for existence. And indeed, what gains we have made over the years have been, almost without exception, a result only of prolonged struggles, and at the cost of great hardship. Last year, in the building industry, in an effort to curb the defiance of the workers, the employers closed down the construction sites, and over 8 weeks tried to starve the workers into submission. For 8 weeks we endured the hardships resulting from the employer's callous action. Eventually, we emerged victorious. The following poem movingly depicts both aspects of this struggle, the misery experienced by the workers, and their courage and defiance, which ultimately prevailed.
The building boss has locked the gates and sent his wage slaves home. We stand in unemployment lines and through the streets we roam. And all the while we wonder how our family will be fed, how we'll keep up with the payments, how we'll keep out of the red. But E.A. Watts and Lewis know they've nothing much to fear. The sound of hungry mouths to feed is something they don't hear. In their boardroom safe and cosy, their future looks quite rosy. And the sound of hungry mouths to feed is something they don't hear. The economy's in a mess and depression's on the way. And the building boss says smugly that it's you and me must pay. We must shoulder all his burdens. It's the cross we have to bear. The government agrees, of course, and says it's only fair. And Dillingham and Costains, with bare-faced hypocrisy, say it's you and me that's ruining the whole economy. While profits must keep on the rise, and the papers print their bloody lies, it's you and me that's ruining the whole economy. But this is not the first time that things were far from fine. I've heard of 1891 and 1929, when thousands were locked out of work for the sake of the prophet God, and despair and fear filled many a street where starvation cruelly trod. And the working man was beaten down and forced to carry the loss for the sake of a wealthy future for the greedy, bludging boss. Thousands had their wages halved, while many children died and starved for the sake of a wealthy future for the greedy, bludging boss. But what will happen this time round? Which side's going to break? Will we be bound by the boss's courts and obey the rules they make? Will we bend the knee to the building boss and the rest of the dingo pack? Will we permit the boss's stooge to stab us in the back? Or will we raise our banner high and struggle come what may until our rights have triumphed and the rich man has to pay? If the bosses cannot run the show, it's time the workers had a go, and that will mean our triumph and the rich will have to pay.
My word. And just to present the other side of the coin, we have here a letter written by the E.A. Watts Company and sent out to all of their employees. The letter was actually written on the 3rd of July last year, which meant that it was written about 2 weeks after the lockout had begun. And we'll read you the letter, and you can judge it for yourselves. Dear sir, you have been out of work now for nearly 2 weeks, and no doubt you, like us, want to get back on the job. From what we hear, there are a lot of people in the industry who still don't know why builders close down construction sites in Melbourne. It's simple. For a long time, builders, labourers and plumbers have been disrupting the industry with bans, stoppages and guerrilla tactics to force builders to give more wages and conditions. Like other employers, we builders know that living costs are rising and that some increases in wages are justified. Wage indexation will take care of that every 3 months. The letter continues. We told the unions that in their interests, as well as ours, these stoppages, etc., would have to stop. And that if they wanted more wages and conditions for their members, they should do things through the right channels. Not impose bans, stop concrete pours, and all those actions that cost builders and clients money. It continues. We knew when we made the decision, and we still know, that unless the unions are prepared to work with us instead of against us, the building industry will collapse completely.
Well, that's a classic statement from Mr. R.G. Gardner, the general manager of Watts in Victoria. But the interesting thing which I reckon needs to be born out of this, and which this program will go into next week, is that the MBA, the Master Builders, lost the building industry lockout. The reason they put on the lockout was, in the words of Watts, to stop the stopping of concrete pours, to have that done away with altogether. They lost and we won. But now, concrete pours have been stopped. You know, the stopping of concrete pours have been stopped, I should say. We're going to go into that question next week, so we hope you'll be listening for that one. Now, we've got a few quick announcements before we wind up here, okay?
The first one is to remind listeners that the Amiga base has just come into the news again, as most people would realise. And the builders' labourers have for a long time completely opposed the construction of this nuclear base in Australia. Yesterday, Norm Wallace, the Assistant Secretary of the Federation in Victoria, made a statement to the press regarding the stand of the builders' labourers on the construction of Amiga. We quote, "We regard Amiga as part of the conflict between the two superpowers. It is another way for the United States to penetrate Australia and establish bases here." And this quote appeared in this morning's Age. Concrete Gang hopes to, over the next few weeks, to go further into the question of union opposition to the Amiga base, why it's being opposed, and the consequences of Amiga if it is built.
Oh, there's just one other announcement. If anyone's got any comments, criticisms or suggestions in relation to any of the material in this program, we'd be pleased to discuss it with them. The address here is the Concrete Gang, care of 3CR, Rhea 1112 High Street, Armidale. That's 3CR, Rhea 1112 High Street, Armidale. A bloke rang during the program, but unfortunately we didn't have very much time to talk to him. But we'd welcome any comments that anyone has in relation to any of the things we've been talking about, or any contributions in relation to our discussions on the Soviet Union or the housing industry.
And in warming up the Concrete Gang tonight, let me tell you something, Keith. Did you hear about the particular building boss who x-rayed all these workers at the end of each day?
No.
It was to make sure that they had no extra work left in them, of course.
Well, it's one more boring Thursday night in Adelaide, and it looks like everybody must have died. No one on the streets and nothing on TV, so I think I'll go and burn my TV guide. Doesn't anything really bring you down?
Thank you for listening to the Concrete Gang 50-Year Anniversary Archive, all those episodes where we dared to struggle and we dared to win, and hopefully you've enjoyed it and come back and listen to some more. You will find it on www.3cr.org.au/Concrete Gang 50 Years. Thank you very much.